Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of One for All. We are that bi-weekly show that rewatches and reviews the anime My Hero Academia, but this week, we're not watching the show, we're watching the movie.
Yes, we are watching the second My Hero Academia movie, which is Heroes Rising.
That's right, Heroes Rising, not to be confused with Two Heroes, which I always mix up.
I feel like that would be a very fair title for this movie, so I don't blame you.
It really, like in the first film, like all these fledgling heroes that don't have their licenses are like trying to save the day. That feels very much like a Heroes Rising title. Whereas this movie, which is so focused on two bud bros and punches, feels more like a Two Heroes
petition movie. To change the titles of the first two My Hero Academia movies. This is clearly where we should invest all of our time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we want to talk about today. Change the name.
Change your name. Jeez.
What is it? Studio Bones?
Yeah.
Change the name, Studio Bones.
I'm going to write a very strongly worded email.
But yeah, today we are watching the movie, and much like the last movie episode that we did, entitled Dave, we will be giving like a 5-minute sum up of the plot because it's long and we don't want to be talking about it forever. And then we're going to do more of our like book club style episode where we ask the big questions and we give the big answers. Well, hopefully big answers. Otherwise, this would be a real short episode.
Yes. All right, so I guess we will dive right into our 5-ish minute summary. Heroes Rising begins with a chase, a very exciting chase. The heroes, especially Hawks and Endeavor, are chasing down the weak villains who have a mysterious figure in their truck in some sort of like, I don't know, coffin type thing. It all ends in a crash. He falls out. And the villain gets away. This mysterious villain gets away and meets up with his buddies.
Spoilers, he's the villain for the movie.
Yeah, he's the villain for the movie. And then we go and we check out our good heroes, Class 1A, who are doing a special project on an island.
Yep, they're in a small island of about 1,000 people doing hero work because this island had one hero and he retired.
Yep, and because the stakes are rising in this universe and we really need to get these young heroes primed for really big problems, they decided the best way to deal with that is by teaching them how to deal with hero work on a smaller level. So throughout the first half hour of the movie, we see them do things like help find missing kids and like fix, you know, tractors and stuff like that and use their powers in a way that's more about, you know, connecting with the community and becoming a part of a community than it is fighting villains. And everyone does a great job with this, except for Bakugo, who doesn't really see the point of being a hero if it means that he can't fight a villain.
Yeah, it's very Bakugo. It's very in character. Depending on when this is in the timeline.
We'll talk about that later.
We'll talk about that in a little bit. But legitimately, they do a lot of odd jobs. We're also introduced to some of the islanders, yes, including two small children.
Yeah, actually, one of Deku's jobs is to find this missing boy whose name is Kazuma and his older sister. Now, Kazuma loves heroes. He really thinks that they're the greatest. He wants to be one day. And Maharo hates them and feels like they are a giant waste of time. So they have a fun dynamic to the two of them. But they are more important than you think because Kazuma and Maharo's father has a unique quirk type. And we learn that the main villain of this movie, Nine, has the ability to collect quirks. Specifically, he can collect 9 and he can use 8. And he wants to collect Kazuma and Maharo's father's quirk. And we see him actually in a side scene go off and attack him. And he thinks he succeeds, but it doesn't work because we learn that the person whose quirk he needs to acquire has to be a certain blood type, which their father does not have. So he's like, well, he has children. I am going to go to this island and attack them.
Yep, he's going to go get this one way or the other. And we know that he's sick or something like that.
Yeah, when he uses his powers to a certain extent, he has these weird side effects. And then the basically it becomes like this movie becomes like the Terminator, where we have them arriving to the island and chasing these children and like taking down everything in between the two of them. So we have Nine, the main villain. We have his three lieutenants, who are Slice, Mummy, and Chimera. And then we get basically like two sections of fights. We basically get the sections of fight where the heroes lose and have to retreat and everyone is injured. Especially Deku and Bakugo, who are forced to fight Nine head on. And this is where we learn about his multiple quirks, and also the fact that if he uses his quirks for too long, he faces painful side effects.
Yeah, he's like breaking down cellularly, it looks like. Not a great way to die. The other portion of the fights in this movie are the ones where the heroes have regrouped, make a plan, and are successful because we still have a show.
Yes. The rest of Class 1A are able to take out the three lieutenants basically by having this divide and conquer plan. They filter them in onto the island in a narrow path. They split them all up and they take them out, having like groups of them facing one of the lieutenants. And then once again, Nine, who is still after these kids, decides that he is going to go up and face against basically Bakugo and Deku. And Bakugo and Deku, they do their best, and it keeps on looking like they have beaten him back. They have beaten him back. They have beaten him back. But every time he gets up again and again and again, and Deku realizes that if he's really going to save these children, he needs to do something extreme.
He needs to do something extreme, which is evidently give One For All to Bakugo so that they can punch someone twice with One For All, which feels like last movie, but we'll also get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that later. And it is successful. There is a very big dramatic fight scene with lots of very impressive music. They managed to take out Nine, and the heroes, the older heroes, adults in the situation, finally return to the island to take care of the results, where we see that even though Deku did manage to successfully transfer the powers to Bakugo, it was not a permanent thing. The powers go back to Deku, and Bakugo has no memory of his time with the powers.
And then everybody goes home.
And everyone goes home.
And the sweet boy that they came there to save, or ended up saving, decides to be a hero and chase after the boat as they're leaving. It's very cute. And then the movie's over.
That's our 5-minute summary.
We did it.
Yeah.
Before we start talking about our opinions on the movies, I'm going to just put this out as a disclaimer. These are our opinions on the movies. You are free to disagree. Some of the things that we are going to say may not mesh well with the general consensus, I think, of this movie. But I think if you've listened to this podcast long enough, you know that Nancy and I are more than comfortable being critical, even about things that we love.
Yeah.
And we're not afraid to talk about what's good and what's bad about a thing.
And I think that is, as we have talked about amongst ourselves, that is an important part of your relationship with a show, especially one that you really like. When you like a show, you don't sort of blindly think that it is perfect all the time. If you feel as if there are some things about it that doesn't work for you, then it is important to examine those things. I must admit, I've been a little nervous about filming this episode because I know this movie is pretty beloved in the fandom. And while I think I enjoyed it more the second time around, I still have some pretty big criticisms for it.
Same. I've seen it 3 times. I did enjoy it. Let's start there. I did enjoy it, but it is not a perfect film.
So I agree. I feel like the first 2/3 of the movie are actually good. I'm actually pretty happy with the first 2/3 of this movie. There are some little things here and there, but they're more nitpicky than anything else. Most of my issues are actually with the final third of the movie, which we'll get into in more detail, where I feel like things happened that were not earned and actively broke the timeline of the show. And they would have been better decisions if they had happened maybe later on in these characters' journeys.
Agreed. 100% agreed. I do think it is better than I remembered on the first watching.
Yeah.
It's about the same as it was on the second watching, as a point of note, since I've watched it 3 times. And I think the first movie is better.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that is not a popular opinion amongst the fandom. Like, I feel like the first movie was also not perfect. And if you go back and listen to our recap of it, we talk a lot about how the villains were extremely shallow and such, and how, you know, it definitely wasn't a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. But I think what has maybe soured on my opinion on this movie more is the fact that it didn't land well for me. And then you end up getting, you know, the Game of Thrones issue, where you may have been enjoying something just perfectly fine, you know, for the majority of it. But if it doesn't land well, that leaves a sour taste in your mouth.
We'll talk about the specifics in a little bit, but the summation of the big problems in the movie are that it takes some really bold, big swings, but does so in a way that it breaks its own rules.
Yeah.
And that, as a viewer and as a critic, is not extremely satisfying.
No,
because
it's not.
If you're going to make rules, you need to play by them.
Yeah.
And that is just absolutely not great to see, particularly when it's a show that's ongoing.
Yes.
And a manga that's ongoing, too.
So it's not like this was the final act in the movie and you could go some big and bold, exciting places. Like, in theory, like, you would have to deal with those consequences in the show, and they do not. It is, you know, like all sort of, you know, these sort of anime spinoff movies, it is standalone. And I think that hurts it.
Yeah, legitimately, let's be clear. The problems that this movie has are problems that a lot of anime movies have, legitimately. But in a lot of those films, they don't take those big swings. They play it relatively safe with big spectacle because they cannot impact the main canon of the show or the manga that's ongoing. And as a result, those are often not very satisfying. But in this case, the spectacle is satisfying. The swing is satisfying. The aftertaste is not.
No. Yeah. I spoke to Anna earlier. Like, I feel like a lot of these big sort of fight scenes, like, had I watched them as animated shorts or something like that, like, you know, you go online and you find like these cool animated shorts with the fight scenes. I would think they were really cool, but they don't necessarily work within the context of the show for me. So I guess let's get into the specifics.
Yeah, let's get into the specifics because, like, we're making these very broad.
Very broad statements. So let's get down into all of the nitty gritty. Let's talk about setting, character, and plot. And we're going to start off with setting. So what did you think of the setting with Naboo Island? The first movie also takes place on an island, Ai Island, but that is a very different island than Naboo Island is, this sort of small town setting. Does the movie do a good job of establishing the island in the first act? Do you start to care about it so, like, you know, when it starts being burned down, you know, in the final act of the show, that it means something?
I think that they do a reasonable job.
Yeah.
Again, it's not perfect, but they don't have a lot of time to spend here. Mm-hmm. This movie has a runtime of about an hour and 44 minutes. Mm-hmm. And a very small slice of that is dedicated to setting establishment, just by virtue of time limits and animation budgets. Mm-hmm. But it does a good job of setting up this kind of small town where everyone knows each other, which, as Nancy can attest, is true of small towns. Mm-hmm. The people here are nice and kind, and they are rather helpless. It's very clear. I mean, these heroes do everything for them while they're here. Everything from my tractor broke down to I need to get to the grocery store and, like, all that stuff. And I think that they're is enough time spent with the characters of the island to care about them, but not enough for you to be like, oh no, Mrs. Smith, because you have no clue what their names are except for the two kids.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like it is a very different island situation than Ai Island. Like, it is more of a charming small town setting. And one of actually my favorite parts of this movie are the scenes in the beginning of the movie where the kids are running around and helping everyone out with all these odd jobs, and they're giving them food as, you know, a thank you and payment and stuff like that. Like, it gives you like a feeling that this is a very warm, welcome, inviting place where bad things do not happen. And I think that's very important to establish. Like, they're not used to having villains here. They had all of one hero on this island, and he retired. Think about that. Like, we're used to seeing heroes, like, you know, maybe die. Like, this guy was able to live until a ripe old age and retire. So it is, a nice, pleasant island. And but the helplessness did kind of get to me as we got more into the third act of the show. Not so much that the kids were helping them out at the beginning, like, fix their car or whatever. It's just when shit starts to go down, the, like, the people of the town that would normally step up in a situation and, you know, go for help, make important decisions as far as, you know, what's going on in the community, they don't really seem to be very present. We have some, you know, medical people who do some healing on Bakugo and Deku, although it is insufficient. But as a result of this, the town folk, with the exception of the two kids, who we'll talk about in a minute, tend to blur together into this sort of, you know, void of helpless victims, which I don't feel like is the biggest problem in this movie, but I feel like it hurts the setting from really coming to life.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, the mayor is introduced mm-hmm. in the film, but when they're hashing out the crisis, like what to do, he's nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
And legitimately, even if he was only present to give history of the island or the castle that they end up going to, or provide the heroes with local information that they wouldn't otherwise have, like that's helping mm-hmm. and saying, we can do this. Like, here's what we can do. It's nowhere around. These people feel like they cannot govern themselves in any way.
And when there's like one thing wrong with a show, it makes you examine other things of the show that you sort of like would have let gloss by. Like at the beginning of the show, like Eraserhead says, these kids are going to be completely alone. There's not going to be a single adult, blah, blah, blah. And you sort of go, oh yeah, sure, fine. You know, they're going to be alone. They're dealing with low level threats. But when this happened, I'm like, was it really a good idea not to have even like the old retired hero around for them just in case anything went wrong? Like, I feel like the decision to put a classroom of children in charge of an island is very suspicious. And had other things about the island been a little stronger, I don't think I would have worried about that as much.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, the movie does a really good job of establishing the island itself and like what the village looks like, but it could be anywhere.
Yeah.
Like, the difference when you compare it to Eye Island is I cared about Eye Island and its people less because we spent almost no time with them mm-hmm. other than Melissa and Dave. But it is a more memorable and unique setting than this very quaint village is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now we're going to go on to some of those characters. What do you think about Kazuma and Mohoro? How do they compare to Melissa and Dave from Two Heroes? And I'm focusing on them specifically because, for one thing, they're important. And also, we highlighted Melissa and Dave as, like, one of the things we liked the best about Two Heroes. Like, we thought that their characters were really well done. So what about these two kids? Are they as good?
It's really... I feel like it's a really difficult comparison. To answer the question, I don't think they are as strong in characters as Dave and Melissa are. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that they are children. They're young children.
Young children, not even teenagers. They're really young.
They do not have agency in the same way an adult does, or even a teenager the age of, or older, of like Deku and company does, like Melissa does. I mean, Melissa, for being a quirkless individual, is a brilliant scientist. Mm-hmm. Like, they can do a lot of things to impact the story, and much of the story of the first movie circles around Dave mm-hmm. and his relationship to All Might. In this case, these are characters that we also didn't know before, but they have no connection to our heroes otherwise mm-hmm. in any way. And as a result, surrounding canon can't anchor them mm-hmm. in the same way. And I do believe it shows. I don't think it's the end of the world.
No.
But it does show.
Yeah. They do make effort in like the first half hour of the movie to anchor Kazuma to Deku, because much like Deku as a child, he has this dream of becoming a hero and he really admires heroes. So they have like this scene where he is talking to Deku and you can sort of see Bakugo overlooking them because he also had this dream of becoming a hero. And I think that does a good job of creating a connection between the two of them and letting you know that, you know, there is a little bit of depth there. But you're right, because they ultimately don't really have much agency, they are the people that the Terminator is chasing. And that does, you know, work to the disadvantage a bit. I do like the energy between the two of them. I like the fact that you have, you know, this one kid that really loves heroes and his sister who is very cynical about it. It has, you know, sort of a nice dynamic that reminds me a bit of Bakugo and Deku to a certain extent. But as for are they as strong of an anchor for the movie as Melissa and Dave? No. And I honestly don't think that would have been an issue if there were other parts of this movie that were stronger.
Yeah, agreed. And I mean, one of the other things, when we talk about the way that the plot is set up at the end and, you know, the bad guy is coming, right? And it's the desperate attempt to hold him off. The older child can create illusions. And we know this guy is hunting the younger child. Why in heaven's name did they not have her create an illusion of her brother and hide her brother elsewhere?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of things that they could have done with these characters to fix this problem, but they chose not to.
Yeah. And even if maybe that illusion wouldn't have tricked Nine, like, they could have at least shown them making the effort and as a way to show that these kids were doing, you know, the best that they could.
Yep.
Yeah. So now let's move over to the bad guys. What did you think about Nine and his lieutenants? And they are Slice, who is the lady who is kind of like the Medusa from the Inhumans character with the red hair that, you know, can make knives and stuff like that. Mummy, who, you know, wraps inanimate objects in these little bandages and he can control them. And Chimera, who is a Chimera.
Go figure.
Yeah. How do they compare to the bad guys of the first movie? What are their strengths and weaknesses?
I feel like they did a better job with the villains this time around overall. Like, we had Discount Magneto last movie. They have cool powers. Their presentation is really awesome. It's very stylish. Even Nine, who is probably the most boring of the group, honestly, really feels almost like this determined businessman in really cool superhero gear. And it's neat. But as far as like character depth is concerned,
shallow.
It's very shallow. The one with the most personality that we get to see is Chimera.
Yes.
Because he talks a lot while fighting with Todoroki and company. And I think that he's really cool and would have been a interesting character to get to know a little bit better. It sounds like he's had a really shitty life and it's really informed his worldview, which is, I mean, seems to hinge on survival for him as everyone's frightened of him, seemingly even before he was a villain. But we don't get into any of that. We just know it's been bad. He's bad. And he's a giant wolf, bird, chicken, man, bear, pig.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I feel like they, I don't know if this was in direct response to the first movie, but there is some recognition here that the villains there were not up to snuff. So we have a definite step in the right direction as far as having unique and interesting powers and having really great character design. Nine looks awesome. Like, there's no way to get around. He looks like a badass.
And he is threatening.
And he is very threatening. But I feel like they do make some efforts towards giving them motivations and towards giving them, you know, some depth. It doesn't work for me. I feel, and as you mentioned, Nine is the one which has, you know, the biggest problem. He has a very generic bad guy motivation, which is, you know, creating this world where the strong are, you know, ward over the weak and blah, 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 which, you know, with his condition that comes from his powers, like, I guess there could be potentially an interesting story to tell there, but because the emphasis is so heavy on the action, we never go into that. So he just feels very cookie cutter and genetic. Like, he feels like not a Discount Magneto. He feels like a Discount All for One because he has the multiple quirk thing going on. And while I do think it is very effective, like in the scenes where he is beaten back and he finds a way to sort of pull himself up with like these tubes that are stuck into him that sort of like give him the juice, I don't think he works as a villain, really, and again, that in the first movie, we didn't really have the greatest villains, and that probably wouldn't have bothered me less if it wasn't for, again, I feel like a broken record for the other things in this movie. It didn't quite land with the villains for me.
I think it's so challenging for this property in particular, where a lot of the villains that exist in MHA are really good.
Yeah.
And you do understand where they're coming from, or they're presented really well. Like, even Gentle Criminal, who is not an overhaul by any means, is an interesting character.
And and I think it's actually, sorry to interrupt you, but I think that seeing Nine right after seeing Gentle Criminal, it hurts Nine. Because Nine is not, like, Nine has almost like an overhaul problem, but at least there was more to overhaul. Like, Gentle Criminal was such, had this like rich, interesting history and motivations, and Nine does not have that. He just looks like a badass.
However, Slice is awesome. I will take no debate on this. She's wicked cool, She is way better than Medusa was in Marvel ever. I'm sorry.
I mean, I'm going to give you a little pushback on there, but she doesn't have that much depth either. Like, she is badass, yes. And she is definitely dangerous and a threat, and they do make really great use of her hair powers. But there's not much there.
There's not much there, but it's cool as shit.
Yeah. Same with Mummy. Like, Mummy's powers are really fucking cool. Like, the way that he can control. Fabric. Like, the, you know, like, he could basically end up controlling Bakugo based on the clothing that he's wearing. And that is, I'm like, that is really neat. But not much there. Still.
They serve the purpose of being an obstacle for the heroes to overcome. But beyond that, there isn't much. They're fashionable doing it and wicked stylish. But it's an empty kind of presentation.
Yeah. So now we're going to move on to maybe some of the side characters. Heroes Rising has made more of an effort to be intertwined with the larger cast of the My Hero Academia anime. It involves all of Class 1A. Well, if you remember, two heroes had only a handful of students that they really focused on. We have the League of Villains, and we also have, like, Endeavor and relatively new characters to the storyline, like Hawks. Do you think expanding the overall cast helps or harms this movie?
I honestly think it harms the movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was made in an attempt to make the movie feel more relevant to the larger storyline, but I don't think it worked.
Launching the movie with a League of Villains chase scene gives the impression of a very different film than what it is from the word go.
Yeah.
And I don't really like that. Mm-hmm. The League of Villains didn't really need to be here at all. The information that they were trying to convey with this is that Nine had undergone some of the experimentation.
Yes.
That the doctor, who works for All for One, was doing. You could have easily have done that with him escaping from an experimentation facility where the doctor was present and stealing the quirks that he has.
Yeah, like some sort of flashback or dialogue amongst the lieutenants or something like that. The League of Villains doesn't need to be here, and having them here in the beginning of the movie, as you mentioned, sets you up with the wrong expectation. You think it's going to be maybe a League of Villains type movie, and then they are gone for pretty much all of it. I feel like Hawks was brought in because he's a popular character, and he has a great character design, but I don't feel like he serves that much of a purpose either. I really wish they had kept the emphasis, except for at the end when the adults show up, like they had kept the emphasis on these new villains and on our students and on these new kids. And I also sometimes I feel like, you know, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, like it's great to have the whole class here and have everyone fighting and really at the top of their game, but it makes things feel a little divided at times. Like, you feel like the only reason we had, like, this whole group of villains that end up being kind of underdeveloped is because you needed enough bad guys for everyone in the class to fight up in these little separate little groups. But the villains, as a result, end up feeling so shallow. So,
You could have concentrated the story on Nine and a handful of students who were doing work out here.
Yeah.
And you would have had more time to develop Nine's story and more time to focus on the individual character development and relationships between those characters who are trying to stop him from reaching his objective.
Yeah.
Because as a villain, shallow as he is, his power level is enough on his own that you don't really need the accessories.
Yeah. Like, maybe one of the lieutenants or any of them could show up as someone for him to talk to and to sort of flesh out his character a little more. But yeah.
I mean, as awesome as it is to see Sero do amazing things.
Yeah.
Because he's discount duct tape Spider-Man. It's not necessary to have everybody there all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that everybody does get a great character moment. Mm-hmm. But that means that you can't actually focus on the fights that feel like they really matter. Mm-hmm. Like, there's at least one of these battle vignettes that you're like, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. It doesn't feel like it is enough of a focus to be worth your time.
Yeah. Now let's get on to some of the controversial stuff. What do you think of Deku's decision to pass on One for All to Bakugo? Does it make sense for both Deku and Bakugo's character journeys? Or is this an example of, quote-unquote, jumping the shark? In a genre known for going to extremes and constantly raising the stakes, how do you know when you've gone too far?
So here's the thing. Like, if this was the end of the series, or if this movie was like the capstone to the series, like, it would feel like this really weighty thing. Mm-hmm. We know that Deku's dream is to be a hero. And this quirk is what allows him to pursue that dream. Mm-hmm. The decision to pass it to someone else, regardless of who it is, and especially to Bakugo, who he has a very difficult relationship with, is such a huge thing. But because none of it has permanence, and because we don't have to live with the actual consequences of that decision, it is abjectly meaningless. And that takes away all of what is good about it, particularly because it's very unclear when this movie takes place. And their relationship changes drastically from season 4 mm-hmm. to season 5, yeah. from beginning to end.
Yeah.
And it's very unclear where this is. And we'll talk about why we know that mm-hmm. In a little bit. But like it, on its own, if you took it in a vacuum, you'd be like, wow, what an amazing, bold character choice to mm-hmm. have Deku give up his dream to save two kids. That's such a Deku thing to do. Mm-hmm. That's such an All Might thing to do. Like, it proves that he was the right person for the power, right? But you don't have to deal with any of the fallout.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think it makes sense that it would be something that, as you mentioned, it's a Deku thing to do. Like, were he put into a situation like this, where his only way to win and to save these children was to give up his dreams, he would do it in a heartbeat. I totally buy that. I am not arguing with that. But I don't think that Bakugo is ready for something like that. I think it does a disservice to Bakugo. Like, he's clearly on this, you know, this is right after season 4, we think. And he's clearly on this character journey to become, you know, someone who is less obsessed with needing to be the best and everything. Someone who is learning about how to work with other people. Someone who is learning about sacrifice. And to basically push off the powers on him too early in his character journey, it feels like he has not earned them yet. And it feels, it makes something very powerful feel cheap. And that really bothers me. I really don't like it.
It's one of the things that's extremely frustrating about it is that when it occurs, mm-hmm. the actual fight portion that comes afterwards with the two of them together seemingly on the same page for mm-hmm. the first time ever, like fighting together to save these kids, it's actually really well done.
Yeah, it's wonderfully animated. Like, they have those moments that you see in the show all the time where, like, the animation gets really, like, the detail goes away because the power is so strong. And how in other shows, they just make things really fast and really detailed, but they just, it completely gets washed away. And I've always liked that. And they do that here. And there's this amazing music. And, like, the animation quality is brilliant, but there's a shallowness to this spectacle.
Because in the end, watching the movie, you know it's an anime film.
Yeah.
And you know, even before they establish that the power has not left Deku, that it can't have mm-hmm. because we have season 5. So knowing from the start that this is a hollow promise, mm-hmm. it just cheapens it so much.
And I feel like it sets people up with wrong expectations because, you know, I've spoken to people that are like, you know what? This is endgame for the show. This is how the show is going to end now. And so, like, they're going to be really disappointed when that doesn't happen, which I feel like is also a mistake. Is it jumping the shark? I mean, not quite. If you look into, like, the idea of jumping the shark, like, jumping the shark is when a show, you know, is famously named after the Happy Days episode where the Fonz jumped over a shark in water skis. So when shows do, like, these big crazy things because they've run out of ideas. My Hero Academia has not run out of ideas. There's plenty of ideas left here. But it does sort of have that sense of doing something that is big and crazy, not necessarily because it serves the characters and their stories, but because it is big and crazy and would be cool to watch.
And it's just unfortunate.
Yeah.
Because the end of this movie makes me feel a lot of things, mm-hmm. which if this was the ending note for the series or something that had real permanence and consequence, I would be really moved by. Mm-hmm. And instead, I spend the entire time being like, well, this isn't going
to
stick.
This doesn't matter. And so let's move on to the second part of the question. In a genre known for, like, going to extremes and constantly raising the stakes, like, how do you know when you go too far? Like, doing big, extreme things is a feature. It's not a bug when it comes to both shonen anime and superhero stuff. Like, how do you know when you just did something big and bold and crazy and, like, fun? And how do you know when you've broken something?
I think, for me, the delineating line is, does it serve a purpose? Mm-hmm. Does it serve the character? Does it serve the journey? Does it serve the plot? If the answer to all three of those questions is no, you've done something just for the sake of doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that that can't be, like, really fun to watch, but from a storytelling perspective, it is not as satisfying as moments like when Deku was fighting Muscular. Mm-hmm. And he's being pushed into the ground and he's like, I'm going to die. Like, mm-hmm. this is it. And the little boy there, whose name I'm blanking on at the moment.
Kazuma.
No, not this little boy.
Oh, yes.
The one who shoots the water in Muscular's face does that. And Deku's like, no, like, I'm not gonna die here. Like, I'm gonna go way beyond my limit. It's this really big moment, and it serves a purpose for Deku to better gauge what he can handle before he gets into things and to not ever give up. Like, that serves a purpose. This was just to be cool.
Yeah. And you know what? I know this is something that people really like about the movie. And I have slowly, you know, sort of accepted the fact that not everyone watches TV shows, media, you know, movies for the same reason I do. Like, some people are really, they don't really want to talk about things like character and story. They really are here for the spectacle, and they're here to see, like, their favorite characters do awesome things. And so maybe that meant a lot to you, and that's great. But to me, it is very hard to swallow when, you know, just a couple minutes before Deku passes the power on to Bakugo, you had Bakugo thinking to himself, boy, I lowered myself to fighting alongside Deku, and even that didn't work out. Like, you clearly have this character that is not ready for a power set like this, who is not worthy for a power set like this yet. And just to have it happen, it's just, no.
I think one of the challenges here, too, from a viewing perspective, is the portion of the fight that happens right before this, mm-hmm. where they're, like, down and out as it is, and the kids are in the back crying because they're scared.
Yeah.
And they cheer for the two of them, gets them up off of their ass, and they push back, and they strike back at this guy in a way that really puts him in a bad position before we have the big escalation that requires the one-for-all, like, double punch moment. Was perfectly serviceable as a heroic ending to the conflict.
Yeah, I think so. It would have been more satisfying to have this be a story about, you know, Baku and Deku learning that they need to fight on the same side than anything else. But
they absolutely had that right before they did this. Because here's the thing, Bakugo doesn't remember any of this.
Yeah, and that is the kicker too. Like, we weren't afterwards. They're like, oh, well, you still got those powers, Deku. And Bakugo doesn't remember a single thing. And it's because, and it has to be that way because, you know, this would impact how he acted in the anime if he remembered. Like, it's done for plot reasons, basically. But that also robs him of potential development. So
it does. Like, their relationship is a central focus of the show. Mm-hmm. And while it doesn't always get the attention it deserves in the first couple seasons, it legitimately is important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bakugo, for all of his flaws and all of his bullying, is an important person to Deku.
Yes.
Deku idolizes Bakugo in a lot of ways and wants his admiration and respect. Like, this fight where they were fighting together and accomplished this amazing thing would be a huge hallmark step in the development of that relationship. And instead, it's just gone.
Yeah. And as you mentioned during our little sum up at the beginning, this is also how they resolved the first movie. If you think about it, like, there was that technology that allowed All Might to fight basically at his old self at full strength. So they had two people, you know, using One For All together fighting together to face down the villain. And now you're having, in the second movie, you're resolving the problem the same way. And to me, that's not very satisfying. I mean, if you're going to have all of Class 1A here, maybe it should have been Class All 1A. Together, they all take him down. Like, maybe that would have been the better decision. I don't know.
It also, as a point of note, because that was the resolution of the first film, before Deku has better control over One For All, before he has his provisional license, having this be the resolution again where he can't handle it on his own, he has to give One For All to Bakugo, cheapens his development that has already occurred.
And you're doing it for a villain that is not is very powerful, yes, but not very interesting.
Or compelling.
Or compelling. Yeah. So we didn't like that.
We didn't like
if
that.
If you haven't been paying attention, we didn't like that. But let's go into our next question. So this movie has a fair amount of fan service, which isn't a new topic on this show. We just actually talked about that with the OVAs. The OVAs have a fair amount of fan service. And every character really gets their moment. But in doing so, we have characters displaying powers that they have yet to acquire in the show. And not just, like, one character. We have lots of characters displaying powers that they acquire in Season 5. We get a line of dialogue that hints about important things that happens for Deku in Season 5 that I am not spoiling for you in case you happen to miss it. We have characters that are just more powerful than they are even in Season 5 and just doing bigger, more powerful things than they have done in the past and will do in the immediate future on the show. Is this something that can be overlooked, or did it harm your viewing experience?
It did not harm my viewing experience until I watched Season 5.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way. So it's common, I think, for the spectacle in anime movies to be higher. They have a bigger budget.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's fine and everything. But, like, we'll use a great example. Tokuyami flies in this movie and uses Dark Shadow as a battle cloak.
Mm-hmm.
That is not something that he does until the first arc of Season 5.
Yeah.
And it's introduced as a novel thing.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the air dates, it is not.
Yeah.
And that sucks.
Yeah.
It just sucks. Because in the show, we treat it as a new thing. Like, oh my God, look at Tokuyami. Like, he's really leveled it up. Plus Ultra Time. But he's just flying around cash in this movie like it's fucking nothing.
Yeah.
I don't know if the pandemic, like, influenced release dates.
And that is a real possibility. But it doesn't explain the fact why, for example, Sero and Ochako are super powered up here in a way that we have yet to see them be powered up to on the show. Like, we do see Ochako have some, like, development in her fighting skills in Season 5, but we don't see her learn how to float more rocks. And again, like, I feel like in the moment as you're watching it, it's sort of like, oh, well, that is really cool. Like, you know, they really dug deep and they had these amazing powers, but then they go away for the show. Like, it doesn't quite work for me.
Yeah, it's really tough. Normally when you watch anime movies, you can kind of figure out where the movie takes place by what powers are being displayed.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually stay within, like, the bounds of what's been established with a little twist.
Yeah.
Or a little boost.
Yeah.
It's nothing that's, like, groundbreaking. Naruto doesn't make new techniques that don't exist in the show.
What about that rainbow chakra? Or
oh,
whatever.
My God. The fucking rainbow Rasengan? Yeah. Like, listen, y'all. It's Pride Month, but not even I'm down with that. So, that's the thing. Don't get me started. I'm rewatching Naruto right now, and I'm in Shippuden episode, like, 350.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 400-something episodes into Naruto. That show is amazing at times, and at times I don't even fucking know what to do about it. But yeah, it's cool to watch, but because of the air dates of items and because it's not even consistent about the timeline. Specifically, there is something that develops for Deku in Season 5, which we're not going to talk about, that is not present, but other things from that timeline are present.
Yeah.
And it makes it very difficult to gauge.
Yeah.
Additionally, when we see the vestiges, because we do see the vestiges of One For All in this movie, it hasn't been, like, super clearly established. We saw them really briefly at the end of Season 4 and not in much detail.
Yeah.
And we see them in way clearer detail, like we do in Season 5 in the movie.
Yeah. And I don't know. I feel like every now and then I'm willing to break shit for a cool moment, but there is just so much of it here. Like, it just it pushes sort of, you know, beyond what I'm willing to sort of accept. Like, I think I mentioned, like, you know, Ochako back in the OVAs, definitely her powers were not what they should have been at that point in the story. And how that, you know, kind of bothered me a bit, but I could live with it. But there's a lot more of that here. But at the same time, I do understand wanting characters sort of have their moment where they really shine. And it's something that I think that the show maybe struggles with sometimes, because there's only so much you can do. So I feel like it was done with the best intention, but fan service isn't always the right decision. Like, you need to, it's good to want to give fans of the show, like, something they could get, you know, stand up and cheer about. Like, that's what I think about fan service moments, like the stand up and cheer moments. Like, we're not going to go into the details, but the latest Doctor Strange movie had a lot of them. but finding that right balance between having those fan service moments and still having that strong character journey and that strong plot is paramount. You cannot have fan service without having an interesting story. And I feel like that's where this movie kind of fell behind.
A good story is a little bit of everything,
mm-hmm.
and not too much of any one thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes the media we enjoy misses the mark on that. I think that happens actually more often mm-hmm. than I think any of us would care to admit. And I want to be clear, that's not to say that this is a terrible movie.
No.
Like, we did not hate it.
No.
It's just flawed.
Yeah. Well, actually, we had to pause the movie a couple times, and we happened to pause it right basically during the act breaks, if you think about it. And, like, we were, like, a half hour in, and I'm like, I don't really have any big concerns right now. Like, there are some things I would have done differently, like the League of Villains that we've mentioned, and how, you know, I would have started the movie differently, but I don't have any big concerns. And then we get into, like, when we have about 45 minutes left, so about right at the end, at the beginning of the third act, and I'm like, you know, still, I don't have any big concerns. I would have done some things differently, but whatever, there's not no such thing as a perfect movie. It's still good. And so the majority of this movie is good. But the things that bother me. So
I felt a lot of the way I feel about the end of Mass Effect 3.
Oh, boy. Now, there is a controversial game.
Where it is something that I really enjoyed watching. But the ending fell so flat for me that it just ruined the rest of the experience in a way that makes me really sad.
Yeah.
And not to, like, rehash that for the internet. If you're not old enough to know what happened, just Google it.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, nerd rage is something that happens every day nowadays. But, like, the level of nerd rage that I saw surrounding that game, as someone that doesn't play PC games, but it still spilled over to, like, my awareness, was huge.
Yep.
So big.
It was very big.
Yeah.
It was very bad. But yeah, those are our thoughts on the movie. It is beautiful to watch. We will get to the plus ultra character of the movie, mm-hmm. I promise. It's beautiful to watch. The spectacle is wonderful.
The animation is great. Like, oh, there are just so many really, like, wonderfully animated moments.
It's really fun and it's really heartfelt.
Yeah.
It doesn't always land its big, big swings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the end of the world, but it is, it degrades the product. In my opinion, at least, to bring it below Two Heroes.
Yeah, I wonder if it would have been less of an issue for me if it would have been like the OVAs, for example, that we watched. I think we were pretty positive on them, even though we kind of laughed at a few things. But at the time, it was like, wow, it's nice to get more MHA. That was sort of what it was. But with this, because it's a movie and therefore it has to be more of an event and the stakes have to be higher and you got to go pay for a ticket or, you know, buy a Blu-ray or something like that. Or I don't know. No, you don't buy Blu-rays anymore. What do you children do? You watch it, you know, on Crunchyroll. I don't know. I feel like I was expecting like a different experience.
My opinions are also colored by the fact that over the last couple of years we've had the Demon Slayer movie mm-hmm. and the Jujutsu Kaisen movie this year, both of which are fucking phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And by comparison, it is really difficult to watch something like this and say, this was phenomenal. It's okay. And it's fun.
It's okay. If you are a big fan of the show, then you should watch it. But don't expect it to sort of, you know, be the best thing you've ever seen.
Yeah, just go into it with an open mind and a bucket of popcorn and have a good time.
Yeah, go into an open mind after we told you everything that fucking happens in this movie in this podcast episode.
Rewatch it with an open mind.
Rewatch it with an open mind. Enjoy the cute children and the great fight scenes.
So plus ultra character of the movie. There's so many choices.
Yeah.
You know who I'm going to give it to?
Who are you going to give it to?
I'm going to give it to Todoroki for fucking somehow killing a man. Who did not die. So just to be clear, there is a point where a group of heroes are fighting with Chimera. It's going very badly.
Yeah.
They're going to lose. And Todoroki says, make an opening for me. And
I got this, guys.
Everybody self-sacrifices to get him his opening. And he uses his powers on Big Wolfman's open fucking mouth and freezes him from the inside out. And sharp icicles, come spilling out of his mouth like he is about to split open. Like, that man was dead. I was like, Todoroki killed this motherfucker.
Cold-blooded.
But somehow, because this is a kid's movie, he's fine.
Yeah, at the end, we see him being walked away in handcuffs. Oh, my God. Yeah, we didn't get into, like, the really strict details of all the fights, but that was definitely a moment I'm like, no. I'm sorry, but that man is dead. I don't know who you were leading away at the end of the movie. That wasn't him. That was one of the illusions made by the little girl to make you feel better. But yeah, he totally straight up murdered a guy in this movie. Oh my God. I was going to give a more serious answer. And I am going to give a more serious answer. But I am going to have to give it to Deku. Because he sacrificed his dream to save two little children he had met all of hours ago. Like, you know, that is a pretty big step. Good job, Deku. That is something a hero would do. So I'm going to give that to you.
I've heard of Iceland, the guy, but good Lord, Todoroki.
That was a moment. That is something I believe that Todoroki could do, though. Like, unlike some of the other characters, I'm like, I bet if he dug deep, he could totally murder someone.
Yeah, I can just see Endeavor in the back. Shoto! Like, he's all pumped. He's like, yeah, that's exactly what you got to do when you're a hero, kid. Oh, but good fucking Lord. I remember watching it the first time and being like, wait, what? And every time I watch it, it always catches me off guard. I know it's coming. And I'm like, oh, God, here it is. But that's the movie.
Yes.
We watched it. We had a good time. We recorded an episode where we laughed a bunch. Hopefully you did too. As a reminder, we are on hiatus for a little bit. Life has been very busy and overwhelming for both of us for a little bit now. Also on my end, kids are home for the summertime and recording time is just a little more difficult to arrange. So we are taking a break. No hard information on when we're going to be back. We're just going to kind of like let life roll for a little bit and then figure that out when it makes sense.
Yeah. And also this is done for a secondary reason beyond the fact that life is busy. We are catching up with the show as it airs and we didn't want to be recording a season while, you know, it was still airing. We didn't want to catch up with season 6, basically, is what I'm trying to say. So this will allow us a little bit of breathing room so we're able to tackle, you know, season 5 in full and not have to worry about crashing into season 6.
And holy shit, guys, parts of season 5 are so fucking heavy.
Oh, yeah, they are.
There are times when I think we're going to have to, like, record an episode and then wait 3 weeks and, like, record another episode because watching it every week was rough for a period of about a month and a half.
Yeah.
So if you haven't seen it, you can look forward to that.
Yep. But, you know, fortunately, that is the end of season 5. See, the beginning of season 5 is the good fun that you have come to expect from MHA.
It's really fucking good. But yeah, we are going to take a break. If this ends up working out for us in terms of, like, timing, too, like, we may see, like, as show comes back, we record a season and then loop. But we're leaving that on just TBD for now. So hopefully we'll see you again sometime soon. Not really soon, but sometime soon. And for everybody who has stuck with us as long as you've listened, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Legitimately, I say this a lot. We have really consistent numbers. We appreciate that you come back week after week. We've enjoyed having you with us and we hope that you will appreciate our favorite anime again. Talk to you soon.
We'll see you then.